Our program tonight features Professor Dale Carpenter discussing his latest book, Flagrant Conduct, the story of Lawrence v. Texas, how a bedroom arrest decriminalized gay America. It's my distinct privilege, honor, and pleasure to present to you my good friend, Julius Terman, who will introduce our speaker tonight. Mr. Terman is a partner in the law firm of Morgan, Lewis & Bacchius. His practice includes a broad range of labor and employment matters, representing employers in a variety of industries, including airline, transportation, manufacturing, shipping, maritime, construction, retail, education, sports and entertainment, and high technology. He's also a former assistant U.S. attorney with considerable trial skills, and he focuses those skills on representing employers before federal and state courts and administrative agencies. Aside from all that, Julius is a pillar of our community. He currently is one of our police commissioners, and he has also led important civil rights organizations in San Francisco, including serving stints as co-chair of the Bay Area Lawyers for Individual Freedom, BALIF, and also the Alice B. Toklas LGBT Democratic Club. Julius, my friend, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the podium of the Commonwealth Club.
Well, thank you. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you our speaker this evening, Dale Carpenter. Rather than recite to you the dry facts of a resume, I'd like to open by telling you a little story. March 1997, I was sitting in my office, and the recruitment coordinator came in, and this was my office at Howard Rice, and she said, "We need you to screen an applicant for employment." She laid a resume on my desk, and she began to, and I saw the corners of her mouth turn up, and I looked at her curiously, and then I looked at the resume and said, Yale undergrad, graduation with distinction, University of Chicago Law School. Oh, wow. Great credential. I read down further, and it said, law clerk to the Honorable Edith Jones of the Fifth Circuit. And I said, interesting, conservative, but very smart judge. And then it hit me, president, Log Cabin Republicans of Texas. And that is where, when I looked up at her and she looked at me and burst into a smile, she said, "This ought to be entertaining." About an hour and a half later, Dale Carpenter came and sat in my office, and I looked at his resume. I turned the resume over, and we had a conversation. From that moment on, Dale and I have never related to each other through papers or comments, but just as two human beings. I learned in that time period that we share so many of the very same values. We were brought up in the very same way, and we believe so many of the same things, even though he was technically a Republican. But what I learned from Dale, as we then embarked on what I like to call our own gay man's version of Thelma and Louise tour around the world, Mexico, Canada, Europe, we have seen a great deal. But what I was particularly proud of is that everywhere we went, Dale Carpenter took the time to learn the history and the facts about the people and the cultures that we touched. It was moving to me to watch him as we moved our way through museums and artifacts and several bars. But when we came back and sat and talked, and we shared our outlooks, I was always incredibly impressed about how different we were, but how close we were in thought as well. When Dale Carpenter presented to me a rough copy of his book and asked me to read it, I was so impressed by the fact that my friend had taken the time not just to learn the history of this case, but to tell in very clear detail the real history of what happened in the arrest and the legal proceedings following the case of Lawrence versus Texas. He approached that writing as a true historian, but in a real way, he was telling our story, the story of men like Garner, men like Lawrence, and men like himself and like me. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you my dear friend and one of my favorite authors, Dale Carpenter.
Thank you very much, Julius. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having me here today to speak to you. It is a great honor to be able to speak before this group. And I do want to thank Julian for organizing this forum. I know it takes a lot of effort to do something like this, and I deeply appreciate that. My book is about Lawrence versus Texas, which I'm sure all of you know was the 2003 decision from the Supreme Court striking down the Texas homosexual conduct law and the laws, similar laws in 12 states around the country. It is one of the most important constitutional rights decisions of the last half century. And it is as close as we yet have from our Supreme Court to a Brown versus Board of Education for gay Americans, ending not only specific sex laws, but also undermining the anti-gay stigma that those laws both reflected and reinforced. To write this book, I interviewed almost all of the major participants in the case, all of those who would speak to me, on both sides, both the two men who were arrested for allegedly violating the Texas law, to the gay activists in Houston, the civil rights attorneys at Lambda Legal, the National Gay Rights Organization, three of the four police officers who were initially on the scene the night of the arrest, the prosecutors at various levels in the Texas judicial system, several of the judges who surprisingly were willing to speak about the case, and everyone else that I could get to talk to me who seemed to have some knowledge about the case. This is not a book for lawyers. It is not a book for law students only. It is not a book for, above all, law professors. I did not want to write a book that was just for those audiences. I think that the American Constitution and the principles that it enshrines should be accessible to all people, not just to a specialized legal community. And the stories behind the journey that is our Constitution should be available to all people and accessible to all Americans, regardless of their legal training. So that was the effort in this book, to write a book that would be accessible to people who were interested in this matter. What I would like to do briefly this evening is to address two fundamental questions addressed in the book. One of them is, what happened? How did this case go from an apartment in East Harris County in Houston to the Supreme Court of the United States? And second, why does any of that matter? Why does any of it matter to the case? Why should we have any concern about it today? Now, I'm not going to address everything that's in the book for a couple of reasons. One, there isn't time. And second, I do want you to buy the book, the one that's still left and available for purchase. And by the way, you can buy more of them, and I recommend you do so for all of your family members, for everyone else who could be could be interested in it, and maybe for a few people who you don't think would be interested in it. Maybe they should be the people who read it more than anyone else. Early European settlers brought anti-sodomy laws with them to this world. These laws reflected a broad worldview that was not anti-gay so much as it was anti-sex, or at least anti a particular kind of sex. Non-procreative, non-marital sex was to be disfavored and indeed harshly penalized. Only marital procreative sex should be permissible under this worldview. Sir William Blackstone, who wrote his famous treatise, Commentaries on the Laws of England, called sodomy the infamous crime against nature. He said that it was a disgrace to human nature and that it was a crime not fit to be named. So not only was it to be prohibited, we should not even speak of it or describe it. To me, that tells you at the very beginning of the history of this country where gay men and lesbians in particular were to be placed. They were not just to be people placed at the margins. They were to be people not heard from and not seen. Their lives were not to be spoken of. As of 1960, all 50 states in the United States had some version of a sodomy law, as they were popularly called. But in the early 1960s and continuing through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we began a ongoing process of decriminalization. This was achieved both through state legislatures, which changed their laws, and through lawsuits filed in state courts. In Texas, which had had a sodomy law since roughly the middle of the 19th century, the law in 1973 was significantly changed, and for the first time it forbade solely homosexual sex. At the same time Texas did that in 1973, it decided to remove from its criminal statute books a number of archaic sexual offenses. Among these were adultery, fornication, heterosexual sodomy, which became permissible in Texas, a crime that used to be called seduction on promise of marriage. And, believe it or not, Texas also decriminalized bestiality. So Texas was in some ways on the very leading edge of the sexual revolution in the United States. So in 1973, Texas declared that it was legal to have sex with an animal, but not legal to have sex with another person of the same sex, even to one to whom you were in a relationship and were committed. That was the great moral tradition of Texas as of 1973. The crime was punishable by, at most, a $200 fine and no jail time. And the reason no jail time was assigned by Texas legislators was not out of the goodness of their heart or some sympathy for the burgeoning, blossoming gay rights movement, but because Texas legislators believed that jail time would not actually be a punishment for gay men. Attempts to repeal that law failed repeatedly in the Texas legislature. The attempts were laughed at. There were snickers heard in legislative halls in Texas. Courts rejected challenge to the Texas law and to similar laws around the country, often on the grounds that nobody had been arrested, and therefore there was no standing to challenge these laws. That stymied the efforts of gay rights legal groups, including Lambda Legal, which was attempting to have these laws removed. And it ultimately resulted in 1986 in a federal court decision in which there actually had been an arrest in Georgia for alleged oral sodomy, a decision called Bowers versus Hardwick, in which the court rejected in a narrow 5-4 vote all of the constitutional claim to fundamental rights that had been made by these attorneys. The court dismissed the arguments at the time as and I quote, facetious at best, unquote. 17 years later, those facetious arguments would carry the day in the Supreme Court. But gay rights advocates after 1986 needed an actual case. They needed an arrest that would occur in a home or in a private space where there was no force, coercion involved, where there was no prostitution involved, where no minor was involved in the offense, no complicating factors, but allowing a clean challenge to sodomy laws themselves. Well, in 1998, the Harris County Sheriff's Office gave them that opportunity at last. September 17th, 1998, which, by the way, is Constitution Day, John Lawrence and two friends of his, Tyrone Garner and Robert Eubanks, were moving furniture in John Lawrence's home. They worked during the day and that night decided to reward their efforts with a trip to a local restaurant and some drinks. They returned, the three of them, to John Lawrence's apartment, where they may have been joined by a fourth man who was a friend of the trio. And they continued some drinking, watching television, talking, and so forth. John Lawrence, at the time, was 55 years old. He was a white man, lower middle class, worked as a medical technologist at a local hospital. He had never been involved in gay rights causes. He was not in any way affiliated with those causes. He had never contributed to them. He was never a member. Was simply uninvolved. Robert Eubanks was 40 years old at the time of this arrest. He had been friends with John Lawrence since the late 1970s. He had no car, no permanent job, no permanent home, no home of much to speak of, and very little in the way of education. He was also extremely temperamental, especially when he was intoxicated, as he often was. Tyrone Garner was 31 years old in 1998. He was a black man who was the youngest of 10 children in a family. Like Eubanks, he had very little in the way of education, a high school degree, no job, no home, no car. He was, however, Robert Eubanks' boyfriend at the time and had been for a number of years. And one of the things that I found out in my interviews of the case is that there was, believe it or not, in this great gay rights decision, an important racial dimension in several different ways. Tyrone Garner was often referred to by his boyfriend, Robert Eubanks, with a racial slur, not simply by his name, especially when he was intoxicated. As I said, there may have been a fourth man in the apartment that night, but I was not able to find him, and at any rate, he was not arrested by the police. He was reported to be a Latino male in his 30s. At some point in the evening, around 10:30 in the evening, Robert Eubanks had been sitting in a chair in the living room area in this small, modest two-bedroom apartment in East Harris County, got up, got some change from a drawer, and apparently very upset, announced that he was going downstairs to the first floor to get a Coke from a vending machine. So he leaves the apartment, marches downstairs a few feet away. There's the vending machine, but there also is a payphone. Instead of putting his money into the Coke machine, he put his money into the payphone. And he called the Harris County Sheriff's Office. He reported to the Harris County Sheriff's Office that there was, quote, a black man going crazy with a gun inside of John Lawrence's apartment. He may, by the way, in my view, have used a racial slur when he said that, as he was quite intoxicated and upset that evening. That call set into motion the wheels of this case. It was easily the most fateful, important call in the history of the gay civil rights movement. Why did he make it? It was probably some kind of jealousy fueled by drinking that evening. We will never know why he made the call. He died in what may have been a gay bashing in the year 2000. So I was not able, he was among those, I was not able to interview him. At any rate, a call of a weapons disturbance is a high priority call inside of any law enforcement department. For the Harris County Sheriff's Office, certainly it was. The four deputies were within patrolling, easy patrolling distance of John Lawrence's apartment that night, and they quickly arrived. The first of them was Joe Quinn, and I'll speak more about him in a minute. But first, the Harris County Sheriff's Office. This was one of two law enforcement agencies in the area. The other was the Houston Police Department. The Harris County Sheriff's Office was a kind of macho, good old boys law enforcement agency. There were very few blacks working in the department, very few women, no openly gay people at all. The department did not have a non-discrimination policy covering sexual orientation, and it resisted any effort to have cultural training to teach the officers how they should treat people who were gay when they entered their lives. So as I said, Joe Quinn was the first of these four deputies to arrive, and that's significant because the first to arrive on the scene of any possible crime is known as the priority unit. So Joseph Quinn was the priority unit at the scene, and what that means is that he was empowered to make a decision about whether to cite the men if he found any kind of crime going on, and having cited them, he was the one to decide whether actually to take them to jail. Now, Joseph Quinn, by his own account in his interview with me, is the deputy with the largest citizen complaint file in the entire Harris County Sheriff's Office. I was told that had any other deputy arrived first on the scene that night, there likely would not have been an arrest, and thus likely no Lawrence versus Texas. We're talking about a matter of seconds, if not maybe minutes, in his arriving first. It was important. He was, turns out, to have been an important, unwitting and unwilling figure in the advance of this movement. According to the police officers, when they arrived, they met Robert Eubanks at the base of the stairs that led up to the apartment, a landing on the second floor, where only John Lawrence's apartment, you had access only through those stairs. The police unholstered their guns, held them out, and then went up the stairwell one after another in what's known as a tactical stack. According to them, they arrived at the top of the stairs, knocked on the door, heard no response, and the knock had the effect of opening the door into a smallish living room in this two-bedroom apartment where the lights were on, there was a television, living room, some chairs, and so forth. No sound. No music, no radio, no television, no talking, no movement. The officers could detect no one inside the apartment. So they announced twice, according to Joseph Quinn, that the sheriff's department was present. They did this twice, loud enough for anybody to hear. You want people to hear because you do not want to surprise someone who might be holding a gun and might react by getting trigger happy. They heard no response. So two of the officers went off to the left to investigate a bedroom that was on that side. Two of the officers, including Joseph Quinn, went straight ahead through a kitchen area and back to this kitchen where they said they saw the fourth man that I discussed earlier, the Hispanic male in his 30s, who they said was talking on the telephone. They told him to stop talking on the telephone and to raise his hand. With the guns drawn at him, he quickly obliged what the police officers told him to do. They secured him, took him to the back, and then noticed that there was another bedroom not far away from this refrigerator where they had just frisked and ordered a man to drop the phone. And they said the light was off inside that bedroom, but the door was open. They heard nothing inside. So two of them, Joseph Quinn and William Lilly, now a detective with the department, approached that door again with their guns drawn, and according to them, With William Lilly in the lead, he approached the door, looked inside, and could just make out two figures inside the bedroom having what he seemed to recall in the interview was oral sex with each other on the floor. Upon seeing that, he lurched back, surprised by what he had seen, he said. And Joseph Quinn, who'd not yet seen the men inside, figured he must have seen the man with the gun that they were looking for. So Joseph Quinn crouched down, went around Lily's left side with his gun pointed straight ahead, ready to fire, and saw the men, he said, on the bed having anal sex. So the two police officers differ in what they saw. Was it anal sex? Was it oral sex? These things seem difficult to confuse. But the police were just not sure. And as it happens, both of those acts were illegal in Texas at the time, were covered by the state sodomy law. So what difference does it make, really? They were doing one of those things, according to the police. Now, Joseph Quinn says that when he saw this, he realized what was going on. He ordered the men to stop what they were doing with his gun pointed at them, and they would not stop. He said John Lawrence turned around and looked eye to eye at him and then turned back around and continued what he was doing. He then said that he turned on the light inside the bedroom and again ordered the men to stop what they were doing, but they would not stop. This continued for what Joseph Quinn said was well in excess of a minute, which when you think about it is a prodigious feat on the part of these men. Finally, Joseph Quinn told me, the police had to pry the men apart. Now, that's the story that I heard from the officers who reported that they had seen sex that night. John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner tell a quite different story. At least John Lawrence did in an interview 6 months before he died. He said that when the police came into the apartment, he was on the couch watching television, about ready to get to bed. And that Tyrone Garner was seated at the kitchen table about 15 feet away from him, that they were not having sex, that they had never had sex, and they never had sex after that. And that the police, in his words, told bald-faced lies. Now, those two versions differ obviously quite a bit, but it's agreed by everyone in the apartment that I was able to interview that the police did, while there, notice some gay erotica on the walls and in other places in the apartment. This excited them greatly. They began calling the men by anti-gay epithets. John Lawrence did not react meekly to this. He responded to the police by calling them jackbooted thugs and stormtroopers and told them, "You don't have any right to be here." Now, at this point, whatever had happened, Joseph Quinn had a couple of choices. He was, after all, according to his word, only having witnessed a Class C misdemeanor punishable by a fine up to $200 in Texas. So like a speeding ticket in Texas, a Class C misdemeanor, he could decide, as anyone who's ever been given simply a warning by the police for a traffic violation, could have decided to use his discretion not to charge the men for violating any law, said, "Where is the gun? Where is this person threatening people in the apartment?" and moved along. He did not decide to do that. He decided to issue them a ticket. Having issued them a ticket, he then could decide whether to take them to jail or whether to leave them be in the apartment. He decided to use his discretion to take them to jail, where they ended up spending the night. And in fact, John Lawrence was dragged down the stairs of his own home with his neighbors watching, clad only in his underwear. The police said that he had refused to put on more clothes. John Lawrence said that they would not let him get dressed after he had responded to their epithets. The next morning, by the way, in an initial arraignment before a judge in Harris County, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, who were charged with violating the Texas homosexual conduct law and without any lawyers at this point, pleaded not guilty in response to the charges that had been lodged against them. Now, reviewing all of this, I conclude in the book, and this is one of the things that's been most remarked upon in some of the public commentary about the book, but I conclude that the men, in fact, were not having sex. I think if there had ever been a trial in this case, which there never was, so no testimony was ever taken, no one was ever cross-examined, no witness testimony, nothing like that. But if there had been a trial, the men certainly would have been acquitted if they'd had a competent lawyer. And in fact, I think the Texas jury probably would have laughed out of the jury box when told the tale that I just recounted to you. So if they weren't having sex, why would the police have arrested them? Well, I think a number of possible explanations exist for this. One, the police were angry and frustrated by the fact that they had been called to this apartment on a false report, as it turned out, of a weapons disturbance. No question about that, and angered police will use their discretion sometimes in ways that charge falsely. Second, there was unquestionably homophobia in the apartment that night. Based on the interviews that I conducted, which are recounted in the book, and things I learned about what happened that night, I think there was some degree of anxiety or tension around Tyrone Garner's gender presentation, at least. He was an effeminate man, and this clearly bothered the police, who were bothered not simply by the fact that the men were gay, but by the fact that gay men, in the words of one of them, do not behave appropriately, act in an effeminate way. Fourth, I think there was an element of class involved. These men, having been arrested, could not really be expected to hire a bunch of lawyers in New York to deal with a Class C misdemeanor citation and take this $200 fine case to Washington, D.C. 5 years later. They could be expected, as many had undoubtedly done before them, to meekly plead out and not challenge their arrests. There was an age difference between the two men. John Lawrence was 55. Tyrone Garner was 31. There was some question about whether that age difference had bothered at least one of the officers who was present that night. And there was the question of race, which is a very complicated question in this case, and I'm happy to talk about it more if you have any interest in that. But I think a mix of these things, but most prominently the anger of the police and the homophobia of the police played a direct role in this arrest. The only evidence we had, such as it was in the case, was a 69-word complaint that was filed that night by Joseph Quinn, the lead deputy, the priority unit. So, an immediate question arises, and that is, why, if at all, are the details of what happened, why are the details of the arrest and of the charges against them important? Why should we care whether they were actually having sex and what happened in the apartment and what happened afterwards? After all, as I think is correct, if everything is as I believe it to have been and as John Lawrence said in an interview it was, the men nevertheless would have had a case, I believe would have had standing, and the facts should not make a difference to the ultimate outcome in the Supreme Court dealing with the limitations on the power of the state to intrude on the intimate lives of adults. So given that, why is this important? Well, I think there are several reasons why it's important. Maybe not so much to lawyers handling a case, but I think more broadly to us as citizens and as a constitutional republic. One of them is, I think we owe it to history to get the facts right, to understand what happened, to understand the motivations of the people who were involved, and understand how they were treated. We owe it to these men to let them finally tell their stories as best it can be told, as they had never been allowed to tell that story through the legal process. They were never allowed to do so. Also, the Supreme Court opinion, if all you know about this case is what the Supreme Court knew about the case and what the lower courts knew about the case, you don't learn about important culturally and politically salient issues like the issues of homophobia, gender, class, and race. Fourth, I think the case is really, when you look at it from beginning to end, a microcosm of the larger story of the struggle for the civil rights of gay people in America. It is full of details that recount police repression, that recount abuse, that include the use of the closet, the fact that people were closeted and therefore were in positions where they could be effective maybe in ways that they wouldn't have been if they had been out, and the resistance that developed to that repression by an organized civil rights movement in Houston, in Texas, and around the country. In many ways, for a lot of reasons I described, this case was an accident. In any number of about 10 points, the case could have fallen apart and never moved forward. But because of the existence of that movement, it was an accident, but it was an accident waiting to happen. I think that's important for us to know. Also, I think what the case demonstrates is that law works at least two different levels in our lives. There is the law that is written. There is the law that we can find on statute books and in judicial decisions and in constitutions. And then there is the law that is lived. That is the law, the written law, translated into the lives of ordinary people. If I'm right about this case, then four police officers walked into a private home and arrested two citizens for doing nothing. Now, why would they have supposed they could do that? For the reasons that I suggested. And what this means is that the Texas so-called sodomy law, which dealt only with specific sexual acts as written, in fact was not a homosexual conduct law. It was a homosexual status law. It was not illegal to do something gay sexually in Texas. It was illegal to be gay. It was illegal to be found in the state of being a homosexual in that state, and had broader implications, I think, around the country. So I think that matters. And I think this story deserves to be told and should be heard, regardless of whether it might have an actual outcome on the opinion, which, as I suggested, it should not. The last third of the book is devoted to the story of how the arrest went from this apartment in Houston to the Supreme Court. And I can't recount all of it, but there are a couple of things I do want to highlight. One of them is that Tyrone Garner and John Lawrence did not immediately decide that they were going to launch a crusade to the Supreme Court to fight for gay rights. There was no, when this arrest happens, there's no sodomy alert that goes out around the country to inform people that there's a potential constitutional challenge here. Somehow this case had to get into the hands of gay rights attorneys. The story of how that happened is interesting in itself, but you're going to have to read the book. I will tell you the first meeting occurred between the lawyers and John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner. The first meeting occurred at which nothing had been decided about a constitutional case. That meeting occurred on October 12, 1998, the day that Matthew Shepard died. And on that date, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner were persuaded that when they had been arrested that night and dragged out of that home by those police officers, it was their rights that were at stake, to be sure, but there were also at stake the rights of literally millions of people across the country. And for the first time, they believed, they were convinced, that their case could have a larger meaning for a whole lot of people that they would never know. And it did. Over the next 5 years, Lambda Legal, in a superb legal representation, turned a snarled human drama with lots of complications and complexity into a pristine legal argument that could be accepted by a basically conservative and incremental Supreme Court. Lambda Legal did that by offering what it called a mainstream presentation of the rights of gay Americans. They argued that in striking down the Texas law, the court would be following the country, not leading it. Most of the country, they argued, had left behind these sodomy laws long ago, and the Supreme Court would simply be catching up to what the country had done, and therefore should reject its own decision 17 years earlier, which was out of step with the sweep of American civil rights history. They also presented the issue in the case as not simply about gay people having sex, but as one of gay people having relationships, of which sex was an important part. That, I think, the fact that they were allowed to make that presentation and could credibly make it, marked a fundamental shift in the court's understanding of homosexuals in our society. From a court that in 1986 had a justice on it, Justice Powell, who said he had never met a gay person as he spoke to a closeted gay clerk, to in 2003, when Paul Smith, who argues the case for Lambda Legal, gets up to make this argument in front of the nine justices, someone whispers in his ear that Justice O'Connor had just sent a baby gift to her former clerk and her clerk's lesbian partner. That is a shift not in the law as written, perhaps, but in the law as lived. And that, I think, helped to produce this result. There's a chapter in the book on the Supreme Court oral argument, which I was there. As you can imagine, it was a fascinating hour in the Supreme Court. It was full of people who had worked their entire lives for this result and were hanging on every word, especially from the two swing justices, O'Connor and Kennedy, and who throughout the argument were so knowledgeable, so familiar with the historical background and the legal arguments, that they were hearing the words used by the justices and by the lawyers on not the one level, but on two or three levels of meaning. It's like watching a movie at the Castro Theater. I mean, the audience is so sophisticated and so culturally attuned that several things are happening at once, not simply what's going on the screen. That was followed by a very emotional reading of the opinion by Justice Kennedy in June of 2003 on the eve of Gay Pride Weekend all around the country. And as you know, if you've lived in San Francisco at the time, you may have heard, on the day that decision came down, the great rainbow flag at the corner of Market and Castro was lowered for just that day, and an American flag was put in its place because those who made that decision said, finally we feel as if we're a part of this country in some very important respect. On the significance of the decision, my book does not actually deal much with the ins and outs of the opinion, the doctrine used by Justice Kennedy. I don't make predictions about what's going to happen in gay marriage cases or anything like that. But here's what I have to say, I think, encapsulates what I think about Lawrence versus Texas as a decision. As long as Lawrence shielded them, never again would gay men and lesbians be presumptive criminals because of their sexual orientation. Never again, they hoped, would they be denied jobs because their lives were defined by membership in an outlaw class. Never again could a landlord refuse them shelter because they were unindicted lawbreakers. Never again would their children be taken from them solely because the sex of the person they loved made the parents misdemeanants or even in some states felons. Never again would their rights be dismissed by the highest tribunal in the land as at best facetious. Never again would their legal representatives have to argue around a precedent that attached a stigma to their very bodies. Never again would they wonder whether the words engraved on the pediment of the Supreme Court building, equal justice under law, included them. The Constitution was now their Constitution, too. Thank you very much.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on the topic of flagrant conduct, the untold story of Lawrence v. Texas. I remind the audience in attendance to submit written questions to be asked at this time. Thank you, Professor Carpenter, for great insight. That was very interesting. You mentioned clerks of Justice Powell who were, in fact, in the closet but gay themselves. And one of them, Paul Smith, actually, as you said, made the oral argument against the Texas sodomy statute. Was there a sense of personal redemption for him to come out so publicly and defend gay rights before the Supreme Court, no less?
Without any doubt, I think there was. I interviewed Paul Smith, who, again, made the argument for the against the Texas homosexual conduct law. He had clerked for Justice Powell in the 1979 term of the Supreme Court. He later came out as a gay man. 7 years after he clerked is when the Bowers versus Hardwick decision came down. And as the court was considering Bowers versus Hardwick, Justice Powell confided to a clerk, even though he initially wanted to strike down the Georgia sodomy law, that he had never met a gay person and that he didn't understand them, and he didn't get it. And the clerk, it turns out, as I mentioned, was gay. And it turns out that Powell had had a string of closeted gay clerks from the late 1970s through the 1980s. For some reason, there was this unreal concentration of closeted gay clerks in his chambers. But none of them were out to him. And the power of coming out had not yet affected him. And the clerk decided not to come out to Justice Powell. Very difficult decision, and it haunted him, and it haunted the gay rights movement for a generation afterwards. Now, I can't say that Justice Powell would have voted differently, and no one can say that, but I will say that 4 years after the decision came down, Justice Powell said before an audience at New York University Law School that he had probably made a mistake in Bowers versus Hardwick. That one vote made a difference, and it was an infection in the law that spread in every area of the law for almost 20 years afterwards. So when Paul Smith gets up to make this argument, he has a lot of pressure on him as having been one of those closeted gay clerks, and his justice was the one who was the swing justice who voted to uphold the law. So he felt that pressure and I think felt some redemption.
So you've mentioned now that the interval between Bowers and Lawrence is 17 years, and in your book you mentioned that a lot had changed. People had come out. There was will and grace in the interim.
It started 4 days after the arrest.
And so the court actually, by the time Lawrence was argued, knew about gay people, even if they probably didn't know gay people, or actually Justice O'Connor actually knew people. Many people in the LGBT movement have pointed out that to delay litigation on the constitutionality of the current issues on Prop 8 and DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is a double-edged sword. Do you see a risk or opportunity in the current set of litigations given the trend of the court knowing about gay people?
I would say I see both risks and opportunities. Before I comment on that a little bit, I would say, it was when the Bowers versus Hardwick case was taken to the Supreme Court, there were people who argued it's too soon. Don't bring that case because a negative case will have consequences as bad precedent throughout the law. So better to delay a few years, make sure that we're right, and get the justices to vote right, and those warnings turn out to have been correct. On the other hand, I will say that when Lambda Legal and the other attorneys in Texas were considering challenging the Texas homosexual conduct law in the late 1990s, they were warned that it was too soon to bring a challenge to the sodomy law. And a lot of people, I think reasonably, thought there was a danger that there would be yet another reaffirmation of this harmful precedent. So this case teaches a lesson both ways. There are risks and potential opportunities and benefits in these strategies.
Since we're on that, do you think if Lawrence was before today's court, given its current makeup, how do you think it would go?
Well, there are still the five justices who voted to strike down the Texas law on the grounds of fundamental rights under the Due Process Clause are still on the court. I'm sorry. They're either on the court or they've been replaced by justices who I think would also be friendly, like Justices Sotomayor and Kagan. So I think there are still five votes for that fundamental right. Other justices might decide that it's now the precedent and will vote to uphold it. I don't know. But I think there are still five votes for that. I'm not sure that there's a sixth vote as there was in Lawrence versus Texas. I think that's a harder call to make. Justice O'Connor issued a separate opinion on equal protection grounds, and I don't know if there's six votes now.
In your book, there are some very personal stories about the moots, which are the practice oral arguments that the attorneys make before they actually show up for Supreme Court argument. But it seems like there was a big difference between the level of sophistication and experience between the people who were actually arguing. So for some of the law students who are in the room tonight and listening on the radio, do moot court practices actually make a difference, or is it already set before you even walk into the courtroom?
Well, there's a big debate. Actually, there's not much of a debate about whether oral argument before the Supreme Court makes a difference. The conventional view is that you cannot win an argument that you otherwise would have lost on the basis of some silver-tongued oratory before the court. You can lose a case that you should have won, or at least you can make concessions in oral argument that might be important, such that your win is somehow hampered. So it can make a difference, probably only at the margins, and I'd say it's probably less likely to make a difference in a major constitutional confrontation like Lawrence versus Texas. Having said that, I think you want to go in maximizing your chances as much as possible, and Lambda Legal certainly did that in choosing Paul Smith and in going through very careful preparations prior to the oral argument in Lawrence, whereas on the other side, Texas was defended by Chuck Rosenthal, who was the elected Harris County District Attorney, who had never argued in front of the Supreme Court, unlike Paul Smith, who I think had argued more than a half dozen cases at that point, mostly business cases. And Chuck Rosenthal never argued before the Supreme Court, and one of his assistants told me in an interview that he thinks he may never have argued an appeal before this case. He was a great jury trial lawyer. Could get in front of a jury and speak authoritatively and with a certain drawl that gave people reassurance. But that's not the same as arguing in front of the justices in Washington, where there's a special argot set of procedures and all the rest. And so if the law students here who are listening take away one lesson from tonight, it's do not make your debut as an appellate lawyer in the Supreme Court.
Let's talk about some of the justices that are that were so pivotal. Do you have any concerns that Justice Kennedy is going to read your book?
I hope Justice Kennedy reads my book, and I hope all the justices read the book, because if I'm right about this, that they were arrested, falsely, and all the other things that happened to them, the indignities visited on them and on gay people throughout the country for decades, centuries. If I'm right about all of that, especially what happened that night, then this case was worse than we knew. It was not simply a case of a bad law. being enforced. It was a case of a bad law being corruptly enforced. That is a double, and I'll use this word advisedly, perversion of the law.
Do you think now that Justice O'Connor is off the court, she will ever admit to making a mistake in Bowers the way Justice Powell may have done?
I can't be sure about that. I know Justice O'Connor, and Justice O'Connor, I think to her credit, actually wrote a concurrence in Lawrence versus Texas that in its own way is more expansive on equal protection grounds. It has more direct applicability, I think, in some ways to, say, the marriage litigation that's coming before the court. Her opinion makes its own contribution, and in fact, Justice Kennedy noted in his opinion that noted the importance and influence of this equal protection strand. So I don't know whether she'll repudiate her vote in Bowers versus Hardwick. I don't think it's important that she do so. I think she wrote a very important opinion in its own right. It happens to have been the basis on which I filed a brief along with Eric Jaffe in the Supreme Court. And this, you may know the Supreme Court cited many amicus briefs in its decision in Lawrence versus Texas. Many of them were very influential, and the amicus briefs were important in the case. A lot of them were cited. Mine probably was the only one that was not.
So the Lawrence decision, as you said, has changed the law that is written. In your opinion, has it changed the law that is lived?
Well, that's a good question. I would say two things about that. First of all, the Texas, if you open up the Texas criminal code, you still find a homosexual conduct law. If you open up the criminal codes of, I think it's another 17 states beyond Texas, you still find sodomy laws. And that's because even though the court has struck down these laws, the state legislatures refuse, almost as a matter of pride, to repeal these laws, to strip them from their criminal codes. It's as, you know, you could make many comparisons to this in American history, but they continue to resist what the Supreme Court said. And if the Supreme Court were to reverse itself, those laws are ready to be enforced again. So that's significant. On the other hand, I think on the plus side, the declaration by the Supreme Court that gay Americans have rights that heterosexuals are bound to respect is an important thing for the Supreme Court to say. For one thing, I think it has, removing the criminal barrier has made arguments in other areas more possible. Certainly in policy areas, gays in the military, arguing for civil rights protections, anti-discrimination protections, it's easier, I think, politically to make these arguments now, whereas before you could just say, well, these are criminals, we don't protect criminals in the law. And also in the legal area, because if you consider the marriage cases for a moment, it would be exceedingly odd, wouldn't it, if the Supreme Court declared that there was a constitutional right to marry someone that you had no constitutional right to be intimate with. So in some ways, Lawrence versus Texas removed a huge roadblock, a necessary roadblock on that path. Whether the Supreme Court goes there in the near future or not, I can't say.
So could you say that Lawrence v. Texas decriminalized the status of being gay?
I think it moved us, yes, very much in that direction. That idea hanging over millions of gay people in the country, certainly people can still argue that homosexual conduct is immoral and so forth, but if they say that it's also illegal and criminal, you can immediately counter with the Constitution. And Americans have a special affinity for their Constitution, even if they've never read it. they revere it greatly, and they take seriously, I think, the things that the Supreme Court is still, I believe, the most respected of the three branches of the federal government. Goodness knows the other two have suffered some unpopularity in recent years.
So you've described facts that are really interesting. I think most people did not know about the night that happened and who the players actually were, because Lambda Legal, as you said, presented a very antiseptic or cleaned-up version of this case. So I've got a couple of questions on that, the aftermath of this sanitized version of this case. On the personal, did Lawrence ever regret that his own story had been so sanitized for the cause of gay rights?
I would regret is certainly not the right word to describe his feelings about the result in the case or the way that it was reached. I think what is the case, I received a call in March of 2011, just a little over a year ago, that he finally was going, he wanted to talk about his case because he was not well. And so I said, well, if we're going to talk about it, I want to talk about the whole case. He had been prevented from talking about it previously. And they said, yes, he'll talk about the whole case. He wants to tell the story. And I think that interview demonstrated a couple of things. Number one, he had a very interesting story to tell, and I'm glad he got to tell it because he died 6 months later. Number two, it told me how much pride he had in the part he had played in the case, how much he thinks it, how important he believed it was to a lot of people around the country, as I said, that he would never know, and generations that he would never know.
Also, Paul Smith made the argument that the relationships, I think this was part of the litigation strategy, was that the status of being gay inherently brings with it relationships, as you just mentioned. You have to be able to love someone if you're in a relationship with them and also be intimate with them. Did Lawrence, or does Lawrence, stand for a pillar of legitimizing gay relationships?
There are parts of Justice Kennedy's opinion that I think can be read as very much relationship-oriented. That's not to say that sodomy laws are only unconstitutional as they apply to people having sex in a relationship. They apply equally to private consensual activity that isn't part of a long-term relationship. So at that level, it's not limited to the relationship context. But the recognition in Justice Kennedy's opinion that sex for gay people can play a role similar to the role that sex plays for a heterosexual married couple is a very significant part of Justice Kennedy's opinion. And it reflects, it is a product, I believe, of the conscious, very deliberate, and smart lawyering by Lambda Legal and others who worked on the case.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one more question. And here's the question. Who was the most interesting interview out of all the people that you talked to for this book, and why?
You saved the last question that's impossible to answer. I want to say Joseph Quinn was the most interesting of the people that I interviewed in a way because he was the priority unit on the scene, and in a way the gay rights movement owes him a lot. I want to say Tyrone Garner was the most interesting of the people that I interviewed because he understood this case at a very deep level. He was driven, I think, by what one of the attorneys described as an internal sense of justice and had little to lose in fighting the Texas sodomy law. I think that wasn't appreciated enough. I want to say John Lawrence was. I mean, he was in a relationship with someone else at the time, and his name has been lent to the case. And I want to say there was a Republican elected judge at the intermediate appellate level in Texas. It was very little known, but in the Texas Appeals Court, the court actually 2-1 struck down the homosexual conduct law on Texas constitutional grounds. And that judge, I said, why did you vote this way? And there's a passage from him quoted in the book, and he basically said, I looked at the law, and I saw that they had decriminalized sex with animals. And I could not understand on what moral code you could have done such a thing but continue to criminalize sex between human beings. And no one could tell me why. And that question, I think, pervades the case. It pervades the history. It pervades the book. And I think it drives, ultimately, the result in this case. No one could give a reason why. And if you can't give a reason why, then maybe we should respect the liberties of citizens against governments that want to dictate the content of their moral lives.
Our thanks to our guest tonight, Professor Dale Carpenter. His new book is called Flagrant Conduct, The Untold Story of Lawrence v. Texas. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.